Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Right now, and pretty much throughout history, if a student doesn't learn something, we blame the student. We say, you weren't paying attention. You weren't focused. You are, you know, are slower than everyone else. You need to try harder. So it's the onus is on the student to understand. And in the meantime, most professors, I would say, are in a position where they are one of the last bastion of content creators. If we want to, you know, use content creation kind of broadly, professors are one of the few content creators where their audience is chained to their desk and they can't leave. So no matter how good or bad you are of a professor, your students have to stay and listen. The whole education system is very stick driven. If you think about carrots and sticks, like sticks being punishments and carrots being rewards, it's usually stick driven and it's not carrot driven enough. Carrots meaning, how do we encourage students to want to pay attention? How do we make the material more engaging, more relevant, more timely, so that students can see how this fits into their daily life?
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Wes, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, Srini. Thanks. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I was introduced to you by way of one of our former guests, Michelle Florendo, who told me that you had worked with Seth Godin on the Alt MBA. And then I had a chance to do some more ding. And then, you know, when we spoke, I found out we both had Berkeley in common, which is, you know, super cool. So I wanted to start by asking you, what did your parents do for work? And how did that end up shaping and influencing the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
My parents were both retired pretty early. So as a kid growing up, I didn't really see them going to work in the normal way that other kids saw their parents going to work. I was very lucky in that they were able to be full-time parents for my sister, my brother, and I. Before they retired, my dad was a land developer in real estate. And also had a grocery store, one of the first Asian grocery stores in Fremont, California. And he was also an insurance salesman. So a couple different things. And then my mom was a student at UC Davis studying computer science. And then she got pregnant with my brother. So she dropped out of college. And she had a couple odd jobs. She worked as a housekeeper for wealthy families in the Oakland Hills. She was a bank teller for a while. So lots of different things. But I think the path that I ended up taking and the values that they instilled in me were obviously hard work. I think that's a pretty basic one, I'll say, for people, you know, who grew up with parents that were immigrants. But yeah, I think the thing that I really appreciated about my upbringing and my parents is that they were not tiger parents. I think a lot of people assume that they were, and I'm flattered because, you know, that must mean they think I'm, you know, I have my act together, and they assume that I had tiger parents. But my parents were never pressuring or strict about, you know, needing to do this activity or this sport or, you know, piano lessons or this or that. I tried a lot of things. My siblings and I tried a lot of things growing up, and we quit a lot of things. So at a certain point, I was doing ballet, tap, jazz, gymnastics, horseback riding, oil painting, violin, piano, writing lessons, math, tutoring lessons, etc. And I was so grateful to have all of these chances to try these different things. And some of them I tried for like one lesson and realized it wasn't for me, like horseback riding. I think horses are terrifying, huge creatures in person. Like, I feel like you see ponies and, you know, calendar. I had, you know, a calendar of horses and these little horse figurines that I played with as a kid. And then I went to ride my first horse, and then you just realize that they're humongous. They're just huge. And same with violin. You know, I took, I think, like two lessons and realized that this was not for me. And so having the chance to experiment a lot and quit a lot actually helped me realize that it's completely okay to quit things that you are not that excited about, or, you know, not that committed to, or don't feel like it plays on your natural strengths. And of course, there is absolutely value in sticking through something and having persistence. But I feel like a lot of times we force ourselves to continue things, and this idea of suffering, you know, for the greater good, that like suffering equals progress. And it's taken me a long time to apply that to my career and to realize that suffering does not necessarily equal goodness. Okay. And in recent years, I've kind of gone back to, okay, you know, back then I quit a lot of things, tried a lot of things, and it was great. You know, in recent years, I've realized that I want to lean into my strengths. I want to do things that where the process and the journey of doing it brings me joy, not some, you know, end outcome of, you know, being the best at, you know, this thing, playing Carnegie Hall 20 years later or whatever that end goal might be. So yeah, I'm a big proponent of leaning into your strengths, choosing things you actually like doing and don't consider a slog. And I love seeing friends who love practicing their instruments. They love practicing the cello or the violin, or they look forward to dance classes, or they look forward to horseback riding lessons, or they look forward to art classes. Like, that is amazing. Like, you should look forward to the thing that you do, whether it's a hobby or whether it's work. So yeah, I think actually one of my greatest strengths, which now that you asked this question makes me reflect onto the origins of it, I think one of my greatest strengths is picking battles that I can win and picking games that I feel like I have a shot at and would like playing, and not necessarily just persisting through something just because it feels like I should.
Yeah, I appreciate that so much, because one of the things that I see in the online world, and this is something that I have said is the ultimate form of bullshit, where, you know, you'll see some, you know, prominent person say, oh, everybody should do this. Like, everybody should start a podcast. And it's like, well, no, there's nothing everybody should do. It's like, you know, when parents said when we were kids, it's like, if all your friends were jumping off a bridge, would you? And I feel like so often people get caught up in that and they ignore their, you know, actual strengths. And as a result, they become average at dozens of things instead of extraordinary at one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of it's weird because we celebrate persistence and grit and, you know, working through hard things. And I believe that. I absolutely think that those things are important. I think we apply it too broadly, though. Like, we apply it even for things where we should probably quit that thing. Like, if you're not that good at something and you don't really like doing it, why are you doing it? There's probably other things that you are naturally better at. And when I was starting Maven last year, you know, one of the things that I thought about was, if there is someone else on the street, like a random person on the street, if they worked super hard and you know, applied a lot of effort, if that person could start this company and do what I'm about to do, then I shouldn't do this. Because working hard is kind of I consider it table stakes. Like, everyone's going to work really hard. So that's not really a differentiator in my mind. Like, there should be some other advantage that I have, some other edge, right? Some insight about this group of people that I want to serve, or a track record of doing, you know, solving this particular problem, or a special zest in wanting to figure out, you know, this problem or whatever. Like, there should be some edge that I bring that allows me to do this better than a random person on the street.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because the only reason I started a podcast was because my first business partner, Sid Zavara, told me, he said, you're an average writer, but you're a really good interviewer. He said, you know, so I think you should take this little mini project you have on your blog and spin it out as a separate site. And to this day, I still think he's right. I'm a far better interviewer than I am a writer. And the numbers kind of speak for themselves.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, let's talk about this whole idea of your parents not being tiger parents, because that's so unusual for somebody of Asian descent. I mean, I'm an Indian immigrant, you know, who went to Berkeley as well. And, you know, like, I had the standard Indian kid sort of narrative of, you know, you want a good life, become a doctor, lawyer, engineer. It doesn't sound like you had that experience. So based on sort of the way that you were raised, I mean, as somebody who has, you know, played a big role in kind of, you know, reshaping the way we educate, what would you say to parents who are listening to this about, you know, the educational experiences of their children, especially the ones who are like, oh, this kid is going to, you know, turn out to be a total screw up, or they're not going to go to some crazy Ivy League or elite school? Like, what would you have to say to them based on your personal experience?
Yeah, I would have them look at me now, which is, you know, moderately, decently successful, I would say. And reveal that when I was a kid, I had a lot of trouble in school. So if their kid is having trouble in school, you know, they can still grow up to be, to decently, you know, have their act together. So I think that's very encouraging. I think even when I look back at my younger self, I'm motivated and encouraged because I remember being in school and having a hard time learning how to read. I remember in, you know, kindergarten or first grade when, you know, teachers would have flashcards and it would be like a picture of something like an apple. And then it would say the word apple underneath. And they were trying to teach everyone to sound out the word, right? Like apple, right? And I wasn't really understanding. And I remember my teacher pulling me aside to do extra exercises with me one-on-one in the back of the room when everyone else was doing, you know, other things. And, you know, she had this flashcard and there was a picture of a hamburger. And she was like, okay, read this word. There was a word underneath. And I blurted out, hamburger. And I was so excited because I thought I had gotten it right. And she was like, no, like, read the word, sound it out. She started getting frustrated and the word was bun. So she wanted me to sound out bun. And you know, that's just one example that I can think of. There's so many where, you know, trying to learn how to read a clock, trying to count coins and add up coins and dollar bills, trying to understand shapes. You know, that's just, you know, very early on in elementary school, but later on, you know, math, especially, algebra, geometry, et cetera, right? Like trigonometry. I really needed extra support. I needed extra tutoring to get these concepts that a lot of students, were able to understand more intuitively just from class time alone. So, you know, so that's just, you know, understanding what the teacher was putting down. And then on the other hand, there's a whole other bucket, which is standardized testing. I was terrible at standardized tests. So it wasn't like, oh, she was bad at the classroom stuff, but, you know, good at testing. No, I was pretty bad at both. So with testing, you know, I always felt like I kind of did decently well. I was like, okay, you know, I think I got this. And the test results had come back for like STAR testing in California and whatnot, SATs, SAT2s, terrible, like terribly traumatic experiences. And the scores would always be very, very mediocre. And I remember one time in school, this was in elementary school, the teacher called my parents in because my standardized testing scores were so bad. And they're like, like, what's going on here? Like, let's talk to Wes's parents. And, you know, they gave an example of a reading comprehension paragraph. So you remember those that kind of thing, right? Where it's like you read this paragraph and there are five questions that show that you understood what was being said. So it was a story about a boy on a really hot day. The boy is walking home. The boy sees a cool lake. And then it was like, what does the boy do next? That was one of the questions. It was like A, B, C, D, E. And I think I chose like D, goes home. And the correct answer was something like B, jumps into the cool lake. So, you know, so they were like, okay, let's see like what's going on at home. Like, you know, why is Wes not understanding this? And in my mind, it made so much sense. Like the answer that I chose always made so much sense. And I always just wanted a chance to explain to the test taker, like, here is my rationale. Here is why, like, this is actually as legitimate of an answer as, you know, whatever you think the answer is. And in my mind, it was lakes are dirty. And my parents, you know, when we were growing up, they're like, oh, like, let's swim in pools. I don't know if this is like a first generation immigrant thing, but they're like, oh, like lakes, like there's like rocks and like, and leaves kind of floating on the surface. And it looks kind of murky and who knows what's underneath there. Pools seem much cleaner. Anyway, so in my mind, it was like, okay, this lake is kind of dirty. And at home, you have soda in the fridge and air conditioning. So go home.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
I'm laughing and smiling because I feel like you and I are sort of kindred spirits. I struggle to tell time. My parents always had to get me watches that basically, you know, only had, you know, sort of digital readouts. Like I could never tell what the hell the time was. That was one of those weird things. Much like yourself, I sucked at math. Ironically, I was failing reading in fourth grade and somehow I became an author. And of course, Indian parents, like,
amazing.
You know, your kid doesn't, my parents like, yeah, no, he doesn't have a learning disability, just shitty teachers. And of course, 20 years later, I get diagnosed with ADD. But I relate to the standardized test because I probably took the SATs three times, which makes me wonder, how in the hell did you get into Berkeley if you were so bad at standardized tests?
Yeah, so ironically, too, I haven't publicly said this before, but I also recently got diagnosed with ADHD. So that's, I love that you are a fellow ADHD, I don't know, haver or whatever. So yeah, I've been actually reading up a lot on ADHD and it's been so, I don't know what the right way to describe it is. It's been a relief, like reading, yeah. Reading about and being like, yeah, I see myself in that. Like these case studies of patients who have ADHD, it's like, oh yeah, I see myself there. I see myself there. Not so much there, but you know, that trait expresses itself a little bit differently in me. And it's really amazing to understand more of how our own brains work just in general. So I feel like that it's kind of, it's added a different layer to how I view myself, how I process and think about laying out my day and whatnot. But anyway, we can get into that later. Yeah. So how did I get into Berkeley with terrible standardized test scores? Yes, I have wondered the same thing myself. And not only that, my friend, I also had to apply at the end of sophomore year at Berkeley to do my last 2 years as a Haas School of Business undergrad business major. As you know, we've talked about this a little bit before.
I did not manage to accomplish. Like I, you know, failed. So.
So no, like that's, I'm just as shocked. And you had to have a good application that showed, you know, your leadership skills, but also your grades for different prereqs. So, you know, micro econ, mm-hmm. macro econ, intro to accounting, finance, I was very, very grateful that I was able to make it in to Haas. I think mainly I compensated in other ways. I think that's probably the best way to say it is I knew that my grades were never going to be a differentiator for me. And my test taking ability was also not a differentiator. And that's putting it lightly. It's like, it's not only not a differentiator, it's a detractor. So I needed to be so much better in other ways to prove that I could be something and that, you know, the school should take a bet on admitting me.
So in a system that primarily rewards people based on, you know, academic criteria like grades, I mean, you and I both know this from Berkeley. Berkeley is a shit show of an experience to go through. My dad had a colleague once when I was in high school who said to me, he said, if you survive undergrad at Berkeley, everything else in life will be a piece of cake in comparison.
And that's hilarious.
Truth be told, you know, I've had a number of friends who've told me the same thing. Like, so my sister went to medical school. She said medical school was a joke in comparison to undergrad at Berkeley. I had a friend who's a Harvard neurosurgeon, and he said when he got to UCSF, which is the best med school in the country, he said that people who come from Berkeley find it to be really easy. He said people who came from Stanford actually struggled with that first year. And, you know, to me, I think the big sort of life skills that come from Berkeley are how to deal with immense amounts of bullshit. I told you the story of my friend who went to Haas. Like he didn't get in. So he took all the classes for 2 years and 2 weeks before graduation, walked into the dean's office and said, my parents are coming on Saturday. You're going to let me walk or not? And at that point, she had no choice but to relent. And somebody once said, like, what is the thing you learned? I was like, I learned how to navigate bureaucracies and manipulate systems to my advantage. That is the greatest skill that came from being a Berkeley undergrad. And it's funny because my grades were definitely a detractor like yours. Like, you've probably seen this, right? When you go into those investment banking interviews or a, you know, Google interview, they'll ask you one of those damn brain teasers. And if your brain doesn't work like that, you're just like,
oh,
what
God,
the hell?
Those,
so this is the, this is my favorite one, right? The, you know, how many golf balls fit in a 747? And now I would say, you know what? Unless Richard Branson and I are going to do a bunch of ecstasy together, why the fuck would I need to know that? Like, I can't imagine any scenario in which that will be useful. So in a system where
I'm slow clapping over here for you right now. Yes. Yes. I want someone to ask you that question so you could give that response because it's
me too.
So true.
So, but when you're in a system like, you know, an elite college like Berkeley, and you're trying to basically compensate for the things that, you know, typically are awarded and typically lead to progress or to, you know, acceptance, like, how do you compensate for that?
Well, in high school, I started a nonprofit organization. And I think that was a really huge leadership experience for me. Because before then, I had never planned anything bigger than a birthday party before. And so going straight into, you know, freshman, sophomore year of high school, deciding to embark on this huge project, that was a transformative moment. And not moment, I mean, I ran it for 5-6 years. So transformative experience overall. So I think that starting Packs of Love was huge. The organization was called Packs of Love. I donated backpacks and school supplies to underprivileged kids, to foster kids, family resource centers, domestic violence centers. And it, you know, in the beginning, the way I got the idea was I was cleaning my room and I dumped out all my notebooks, pencils, pens, markers onto the floor, and I had a bunch of stuff from, you know, Hello Kitty, Lisa Frank, you know, all my goodies, and I was kind of organizing them. And my dad walked into my room and took one look at you know, this explosion of stationery and said, you know, you are so lucky. You don't know how lucky you are. There are kids who don't have a fraction of this, and blah, 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 blah. And usually during his lectures, I would smile and nod and wait for him to go away. And you know, this time after he went away, I continued organizing, and I thought about what he said and realized that I did have more notebooks and brand new pens and pencils than I would ever have a chance to use. And what if I donated some of them to kids who might need them? And so I thought of this and was immediately very proud of myself for thinking of this. And it wasn't until I tried executing a couple weeks later that I realized that turning this idea from an idea into a reality was much harder than I thought. And I realized this because I started going around to local stores in my neighborhood to ask for donations. So I would go to Long's Drugs, Walmart, Target, Walgreens, and I would ask to speak to the store manager, and I would bring this folder with me with a write-up of my proposal of what I wanted to create. And I would wear my only button-down shirt and some black capri pants to look a little bit more professional. And I would go around and ask to speak with these store managers. And pretty much every single manager laughed in my face and said, "You are a kid trying to get some free stuff. I see you. This is a joke. Goodbye." And it was very demoralizing. And at the same time, I was kind of like, okay, yeah, I can see how me showing up in your store asking for free stuff could, you know, like could be interpreted that way. Like, I didn't have any credibility. I was a single random person. I wasn't part of an organization or, you know, a school club or affiliated with anything. Like, I really was just a random kid asking for, you know, pencils, notebooks, and backpacks. And so I understood their skepticism. So, you know, I ended up trying a bunch of different things. I wrote a bunch of letters to different corporate offices. You know, back then I really did not have a single clue what I was doing. So I would address a letter to like one Microsoft way to who it may concern. And like, you know, the Microsoft campus is like a mini city with multiple departments, like thousands of people. I wrote it to like the lobby or something. Like, who knows where that letter goes? Probably directly into the trash can. Anyway, I sent out hundreds of letters. I also wrote to backpack companies, backpack brands like JanSport, Eastpak, to try to get donations, to Pentel, and a bunch of other stationery companies, Staples. And anyway, none of it worked. So kept getting rejected. It was all great because I learned, okay, this is hard and I should keep trying. And so, okay, like I now know what doesn't work. Anyway, that first year that I was doing Packs of Love, I ended up needing to use my own money to buy backpacks and school supplies to donate to a shelter that I had already promised I was going to get them 50 backpacks. And I felt so bad about it that I was like, okay, I'm just gonna buy this and keep trying. The one thing that I did do that was pretty clever was after I donated those initial 50 backpacks, I called the local newspaper and I told them, hey, here's what I'm doing. Here's the donation that I just made. I'm trying to build this charity. And you know, if you think this is something that could be interesting to share with the community, let me know. And a reporter replied and was like, yeah, like this is super cool. You're, 15, 16 year old trying to do this. Like this is kind of random and kind of neat. So yeah, I'll cover it. And I ended up getting on the front page of the local newspaper. And this was a huge win and probably the first win out of, you know, months of effort. So I bought 50 copies of the newspaper. And I then went around to all of the same stores who rejected me and mailed this newspaper clipping to all the companies that replied saying, sorry, we're not able to donate. And the same places that rejected me all of a sudden were interested. Now I had a little bit of credibility and I also dangled the possibility of, you know, hey, if you donate, I'll mention it to the reporter the next time that I'm interviewed that, you know, the store manager at Walgreens in this local store was able to donate and, you know, and that'll make you look good. It'll make you seem like part of the community, giving back. And I basically did this cycle and worked up the ladder over the next 5-6 years until I was getting backpacks, boxes of backpacks shipped to my house and talking to district managers who managed dozens of stores statewide to offer donations and was negotiating these deals every summer in preparation for the fall donation time. And got other students at my high school involved and expanded into donating more and more backpacks every year. And this ended up being one of the most formative periods of my life. And it showed me that I could make change happen. It showed me that I could take an idea from being an idea and turning it into something that was real, something that, that other people understood and change something in the physical world, right? Like not just in my own head with an idea, but something actually in the physical world that I could build something. And it also taught me the importance of marketing. I didn't really know what marketing was until this time, until I realized that the way that I tell my story, the way that I position this charity, the way that I describe the impact, the way that I align incentives with the people that I am trying to get donations from, the way that I celebrate the behavior that I want to see. All of this I realized was marketing. And that was really what planted this initial seed of, wow, marketing is so incredibly powerful. It is literally the difference between people closing doors in your face and saying that you are a joke to people signing $1,000 checks and mailing you thousands of dollars worth of product because they believe in you. And because they believe in what you're able to do, they believe in your vision.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Wow. Okay. Amazing. So let's shift gears a little bit. How do you go from Berkeley to working with Seth? And talk to me about the experience of working with Seth, because I've had probably half a dozen people here who've all basically said it's completely insane. It pushes you to your limits. And what he proposes often sounds impossible.
Yeah, that's very, very accurate. Now I know that you actually talk to people who worked with Seth. Because before I was kind of like, okay, like, you know, some people will meet Seth, you know, they'll come by our office in Hastings on Hudson and sit with him for an hour and talk to him and be like, oh, I worked with Seth on this and this. But people who really worked with Seth would would say something different, which is, yes, it's freaking intense and completely bonkers and extreme in many, many ways. And so, yes, like the way that you described it just there is pretty much what it was like for 3 years.
Yeah, I think it was Willie Jackson or even Seth may have told me that up for the Domino Project, like on, I think, 2 weeks
ago. Yeah, I love Willie.
He told them he was going to fire everybody if they didn't do something.
Yep, that sounds about right. That's hilarious.
Well, I think the thing that I find so insightful about Seth, and I think also is so challenging with his material for a lot of people, is he doesn't give people a map. He gives them a compass. And he basically forces you to figure things out on your own is one of the things that I've observed in the way that he teaches. And, you know, like if you look at the negative reviews of any Seth Godin book, the one common complaint I feel like you see is he doesn't actually explain how to do this. And I realized that is by design based on the conversations I've had with him. So I think that makes a perfect segue into talking specifically about designing transformational learning experiences, because I mean, you and I are kind of like, as I would like to joke, failed byproducts of a traditional education system. Like, we've been able to accomplish what we have, not because of Berkeley, but in spite of it. So when you look at, you know, education in its traditional form and also, you know, how people learn online, what is it that leads to the kind of transformation that produces the outcomes that people who come out of creative MBA or alt MBA get? I know this. My cousin Rama was thinking about an MBA and I told her not to do it. I said a business school is a complete waste of time and money. It doesn't teach you shit about how to run a business. And so I referred her to alt MBA and she got like a massive promotion afterwards, where she's now like one step down from the CEO of her company. And then she ended up starting a business too. And
amazing.
So one of the things I'm very curious about is, you know, typically, what I've seen when I look at the way that people consume content, particularly on the internet or take online courses, something like 80% of people never even fucking log in. They spend like $1,000 on something and they never open the damn course. I've seen this, you know, with my own students. I've seen it in myself. I mean, something changed at some point where I just learned how to do this. But the thing is that I think that there's also responsibility on the part of the person who creates something to create a design experience that actually facilitates real learning. Because, you know, I think now about college in particular, and I think back to things like, you know, Econ 101, which is the course that you and I took, right? And this is one of those sort of realizations I came to as I was reading The Wealth of Nations, which I would have never been able to do in college. And that is, you go into, you know, an econ class at a place like Berkeley, and what do? You know, highlight and underline the shit out of a textbook. Like if you go and pick up a used textbook, you'll see that somebody has like highlighted the entire book as if that's going to be of any use. And then you do problem sets and you think you understand something, and then you get to the midterm and they present this idea in a context that you've never seen before. And that's when you realize you didn't actually learn it. So anyways, given, you know, the role that you have played in Alt MBA, like what is it that needs to change about the way that we design these learning experiences? Like what are the foundational elements that lead people to have transformative experiences, which I realize is a question we could spend 3 hours talking about.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is a mindset shift. So right now, and pretty much throughout history, if a student doesn't learn something, we blame the student. We say you weren't paying attention, you weren't focused, you are slower than everyone else, you need to try harder. So it's the onus is on the student to understand. And in the meantime, most professors, I would say, are in a position where they are one of the last bastion of content creators. If we want to, you know, use content creation kind of broadly, professors are one of the few content creators where their audience is chained to their desk and they can't leave. So no matter how good or bad you are of a professor, your students have to stay and listen. They have to attend your lectures. They have to attend the discussion sections. And the whole education system is very stick driven. If you think about carrots and sticks, like sticks being punishments and carrots being rewards, it's usually stick driven. It's saying, you know, you won't be able to pass this course, so you won't get the credits. You'll have a dark smudge on your report card or on your GPA, or you won't be able to graduate with this major. That'll be looked down upon if you ever apply to grad school, or, you know, future employers won't like that. So it's very, very stick driven, and it's not carrot driven enough. Carrots meaning, how do we encourage students to want to pay attention? How do we make the material more engaging, more relevant, more timely, so that students can see how this fits into their daily life, or how it shapes them to become a more critical thinker on a more macro level? So I think this mindset shift, this philosophical shift of instructors embracing that they are responsible for their students' transformation, and embracing that in today's day and age, you have to be 50% instructor, 50% entertainer.
Yeah.
You can't just spew facts, because first of all, if you were just spewing facts and someone could just watch a video of you doing that, and probably a more engaging professor, a video of a more engaging professor doing that. And so if you're teaching live, thinking about, you know, how do I embrace that I am both sharing knowledge and content and information, but also thinking of myself as someone who wants to keep their audience entertained. I think that's increasingly important, especially if you are not a professor. Like, just, you know, I was using higher ed as an example, but especially if you are teaching a cohort-based course or a self-paced Udemy course, and you don't have those sticks. Your students are taking your course because they want to improve themselves out of their own free will. They're not doing it because they get punished if they drop out of your crypto course, or if they drop out of your, you know, leadership and management course, right? So it's even more important for the majority of us who are not in the traditional education system, who are teaching outside of it, to embrace this idea of 50% instructor, 50% entertainer.
You know, it's funny you say that, because that literally is part of the reason that I ask all these completely irrelevant questions to start a podcast, because, you know, this is something I realized a lot of online marketers overlooked. I was like, a podcast is a storytelling mechanism first. Like, audio is an entertainment medium first and an information medium second. Like, nobody wants to hear 10 tips on how to grow your Facebook following on a podcast. That'd be fucking mind numbing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, those are my three pillars, is entertainment, education, and inspiration. Like, those are, people always ask, like, is there a criteria for how you choose? It's like, if we can accomplish those three goals, that's a perfect guest. And, you know, they're not mutually exclusive. Sometimes it's just entertaining, you know, and not necessarily educational. But I think if you can get that trifecta down, to me, that's like how you create really emotionally resonant content. So one thing that always struck me about the concept of Alt MBA was that there are no homework assignments, there's no lessons, there are no lectures, which, you know, is so different than anything out there. And I remember one of our copywriters said, you know what, if we're going to teach this writing course, let's do it differently. He said, instead of having you come and, you know, have people watch you present slides to them, make them watch all the lecture material before they come there, and just use, you know, the hour that you have with them for discussion. That ended up being invaluable, and it was a hell of a lot more fun for me.
Yeah, I think when you have live experiences, you really want to spend it doing stuff that you can only do live. So with first-time course creators, I always recommend that they aim for having 75% of their workshop be interactive. So discussions, debates, critiquing each other's work, giving each other feedback, doing demo days, pitching something, then you know, people reviewing each other's pitches, breakouts, and then that 25% is lecture, or anything that, you know, you really can't think of a way for people to learn this in a more active way, then you put that as lecture. Mm. Whereas, you know, the default that most instructors do is think, okay, it should be 75% lecture. That, you know, I have a lot of material I want to get through. I want to tell you all these things. So it ends up being very lecture heavy. And I've never heard a student after a course say, gosh, I wish there had been more lectures. People usually say, I wish I had more time to meet other students, or I wish we could have done this breakout for longer because so-and-so was giving me really insightful advice that I just hadn't thought of before. Our group was getting into this really heated debate and it was changing the way I was thinking about a couple things. And that kind of pushing that you get from working with peers, from working on a project hands-on and really needing to get into the nitty-gritty of it, you know, not stay at a high-level theoretical level, but really get into it as a group when you're working on a project together, that is so much more impactful and teaches you so much more about how to think and helps you reflect on even what you think than having a lecturer talk at you for the majority of the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that you've played a role not only in Alt-MBA, but also with Tiago Forte, just building a second brain, which, yeah, that has been one of those concepts that's been life-changing for me and, you know, a lot of people who truly understand it. So it's funny because you're kind of making me think about the course that I created recently. I have a course on Mem, the note-taking app, and people are in it. But what's funny is the best parts of that course are when I interact with Mem's Slack channel and the people who are there, some of who are, you know, students, you know, some of them are employees of Mem. It's not necessarily like, you know, lecture, and it's kind of making me rethink the design of the course just talking to you. But so starting with this idea of, you know, 75% live and, you know, 25% lecture, let's just say we're starting from the ground up with something, you know, or even using Tiago as an example. What is it that, you know, he does differently that you've seen than anybody else that makes the course so much more valuable than, say, other learning experiences? Because, you know, I was thinking about this last night. I was writing about this idea of taking smart notes. And Eric Wall, who we had here years ago as a graffiti artist, he told me something that I have never forgotten. He said, live music has engaged participants. Keynote speaking has passive consumers. There's room to be explored in how you bridge the gap. And that had a huge impact on everything I did, from the way that I planned events to now thinking about it, even in the context of how you take notes and how you create an online course. I'm realizing that really is, you know, a huge differentiator.
Yeah. If you look at evergreen self-paced courses, on-demand courses, they're basically a series of videos. And that is a passive content consumption activity. That's pure passive content consumption. Whereas if you look at a cohort-based course or anything with a live component, it's much more interactive. That's why your students are picking a cohort-based experience over a static async experience. It's because they want that community. They want that interaction. They want to talk about ideas and have other real humans listening and reflecting back. And they want to hear other real humans ideas on this topic. And yeah, I think that the passive versus active piece is a really key difference between MOOCs versus cohort-based courses. And it's one of the main reasons why cohort-based courses are growing in popularity, because MOOCs, it's, you know, people tried it and the completion rates are super low, anywhere between 7-10%. And a recent MIT study said even lower, 3-6%. So I think a lot of us have had that experience where we tried doing something on our own. Like if it could work, it'd be pretty great. Like if I could get myself to watch a bunch of these videos to learn a thing and motivate myself and keep myself accountable, I totally would. But it's the fact that like that's hard and I can't do that. I've attempted it and I couldn't. And instead, committing to a course where there is a start and end date, like that, even that immediately creates a sense of urgency and creates a sense of focus of, all right, well, this course is 2 weeks. Once this 2 weeks is over, can't turn back time, can't get my money back. Like I should focus during these 2 weeks. Even that alone helps me prioritize learning this thing, you know, long enough for me to actually stick around and learn it. I think that accountability piece is something that I think all of us need when we're learning something new. And when things get hard, it's just so easy to give up if no one's watching. But if you are, if you've already committed to doing a course and you know that your fellow students are going to be disappointed if you just dropped out, that's often enough to keep you going.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I love the idea. You're making me think I could condense a 6-week course into 2 weeks and still deliver the same value.
Yeah. I think with core-based courses, the exciting thing is that there are so many different ways that you can lay out a course. And the experimentation is part of it's a feature of core-based courses. So with a MOOC, for example, you put a lot of effort into recording everything, scripting everything, polishing it, editing it. And then once it's done, it's kind of there and it's hard to go back and change certain things. But when you are live, the live modality lends itself to experimentation. It lends itself to going with what your particular group of students in this particular cohort is interested in. Yeah. And it might be that you went in with, a hypothesis that, you know, this part I can kind of go over quickly because people get it or they're not going to be that interested. And then when you're actually sharing it, it turns out that your students are very interested in this topic and they want to spend the rest of the workshop on the topic. So you have that option when you're doing something live to cater that material to your audience. And I think also with what you said with doing a 6-week course in 2 weeks potentially. Yeah, absolutely. I think the way that Maven teaches course building is very modular. So I see different modular components and parts of a course. And then once you have these components, if your course is 6 weeks, if you wanted to create a condensed version of that, you don't have to start from scratch. It's not like you burn everything from your 6-week course and then start from scratch with the 2-week course. You can reuse a lot of stuff from your 6-week course and you put it in a different container where the constraint is now a shorter length of time, let's say 2 weeks. And then you think about, all right, how do I rearrange these different components to make it something that is shorter? Or you can go the other way. You can make it longer. Let's say you wanted to do an extended version, a 12-week course. You can also rearrange these different components to stretch certain things out, condense other things. So I love approaching courses and, you know, projects and products in general with this modular mindset where you have that flexibility to change up certain constraints, but still reuse a lot of the great stuff that you already created for your course.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. One thing that I wonder is, what is it going to take to make this a more predominant narrative in traditional education? Because I remember talking to Salim Ismail here. We're talking about Singular University. And, you know, this is probably the thing that struck me most in our conversation. He said, you know, we can't get accredited. You know why? He said, because we update our curriculum in real time. I was like, so let me get this straight. You're actually teaching people to adapt to current times. And for that reason, you can't get accredited. And he said, yeah, accreditation is a giant mess that prevents, you know, like this kind of stuff from actually becoming more predominant in traditional education.
Yeah, accreditation is a whole other beast that I don't know very much about because our core-based courses, Mavens, are, and the ones that I've worked on before that, so Alt MBA, Tiago's course, Build a Second Brain, Rite of Passage, all these courses were non-accredited and were geared towards adult learners who are upskilling, retooling, improving themselves on their own volition. So the whole accreditation piece with, you know, getting college credits to go towards a degree or, you know, to go towards something more formal is not something that I have a ton of experience in. And I also don't really know if I am a huge proponent of that idea. I mean, when Seth Godin and I started the Alt MBA, we talked about accreditation and we talked about credentialing. And there are pros and cons of credentialing. There are some instructors and courses who where it makes sense to go that path to give a certificate or a document of completion of some sort. So that totally makes sense. But with the Alt MBA, we didn't want to do that. And it actually felt antithesis to the whole point of the Alt MBA. It's the Alt MBA's philosophy was, if you are doing a course, you should measure the results of that experience based on how you change afterwards and how your behavior is now different, how your mindset is now different, and the results that you get because you are now an improved person. It's kind of like if you take a sales course, is the certificate that you took this sales course the important part, or the fact that you can now close sales in half the time and you have, you know, you're way more confident going into pitches, like, right? So, you know, I think it's really the latter.
Yeah.
So
totally.
I see both sides of that piece. And I think more and more professionals are seeing that they don't need to go in the traditional education system and get accredited, et cetera, to, or get a certificate to see the result and value that they want to see from taking a course. They can measure the worth of that course differently.
It's funny you say that, because like Nat Aleason has this course on Rome, and you know, I went in and I took the whole course and I was like, all right, I'm still terrible at using Rome. But because of that course, I was able to create my note-taking course. Like, I used all the concepts and just applied them to another tool.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about one final thing, which should bring us full circle. We started out kind of talking about moving towards the things that you are naturally good at. And I think a lot of people ignore that advice constantly, because you have this sort of, you know, thing where social influence plays a big role. Like, personally, I think the biggest bunch of bullshit to ever come out of any online marketer's mouth is everybody should start a podcast. And I'm like, no. If you're an introverted visual artist who doesn't like talking to people and you're amazing at doing that, don't start a podcast. If you suck in front of the camera, don't start a YouTube channel. And yet, the problem is that if somebody who's highly influential says this, people treat their word as gospel instead of guidance without thinking about this or questioning it in the context of their own lives. How do they actually develop the capacity to consider context and when it comes to prescriptive advice?
Oh man, this is a really, really great question. I often think about this when I tweet something and then the comments are, you know, people who are pointing out an edge case or, you know, a different situation, and they're basically applying what I'm saying too literally. And usually I agree with those comments. It's like, yes, I had 280 characters, but otherwise I agree with what you're saying too. Like, there are multiple ways of looking at something. I think developing that sense of judgment is very, very important. I've thought a lot about how to help people develop this sense of judgment and intuition around how do I tell if a piece of advice works for me? Because if you think about it, we get conflicting advice all the time. We simultaneously hear patience is a virtue and good things come to those who wait. And then we also hear that, you know, you have to go out and get the things you want. Or, you know, if you wait too long, life just passes you by. And it's like, okay, well, both things are true, but applying it and having the wisdom and judgment to apply the right piece of advice to your own situation is a skill in and of itself.
Yeah.
So I think that this is a pretty big issue. And that's kind of the macro point, but going to your immediate question of you know, certain people shouldn't start podcasts or certain people shouldn't do certain things. Everything takes longer than you think. This is one of my mantras. And I am at least on a weekly basis reminded that everything takes longer than you think. So the reason you want to do stuff that you are good at and actually like doing is because everything takes longer than you think. If you thought this was going to be an easy piece of cake overnight success, then yeah, if this were kind of hard and you didn't really like it, but you were going to see the light at the end of the tunnel right away, then it might make sense to do. But because everything takes longer than you think, even for something that you are good at and like doing, there are going to be rough parts where you don't really feel like continuing and where you question whether any of this was a good idea at all. So leaning into your strengths and doing stuff that comes more naturally to you where you have an edge makes it all a lot more joyous of a process, which means that you are more likely to stick with it long enough to actually see the light at the end of the tunnel. Mm.
I appreciate that more than you can possibly imagine, because I just, you know, when I see people follow prescriptive advice, they don't consider context, you know, and part of the problem is that are almost all our sort of role models are outliers, right? Because they're the people who write books. They're the people who appear on shows like this. You know, they're the ones who are on the covers of magazines. You know, we had Justine Musk here, and probably one of the things that struck me most that she said about Elon is she said, I don't want to get all deterministic, but I don't think this is something you can learn to be like this, you know, to think like this. That's something that is innate, you know, and yet you see all these articles on, you know, sites like Medium. It's like, oh, 10 ways to be like Elon Musk. And it's like, yeah, but you're not a fucking genius. So maybe that's not going to work for you.
Yeah, you can do those 10 things and any list of things and not still be hit. I think that that's a something that struck me a lot when I was working with Seth, because a lot of people would admire Seth and want to imitate him, and they would try to write in his style. So, you know, short daily blog posts, right? If you look at what does Seth do? Okay, on the surface, he does short daily blog posts. And so a bunch of people would start doing short daily blog posts, and it wouldn't really work. Like it just didn't land the same way. And the reason is because
you're not
the
Seth.
Short daily blog post, right? It's but beyond that, that's the tactical expression of a deeper underlying skill set, principle, personality, etc. That is uniquely Seth. That if you just copy the tactic, you're not replicating the other stuff. The other stuff is the important stuff, and that's the underlying stuff, which is Seth is incredibly insightful. He sees things differently and is able to capture and articulate those insights in a way that feels mind-blowingly breakthrough, but also weirdly obvious at the same time. Like, you read it and you're like, oh my God, like, of course, why didn't I think of that? Like, that's like the best way to say this thing that I've been feeling all along, right? He's able to distill complex ideas into really simple, impactful concepts. And he's an amazing writer. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like you kind of know this because you're like, okay, well, he's an author by trade. Yeah. He's written 18 best-selling books. So you, on the surface, you intellectually understand that he's a great writer. But I think when you read his posts, he's so good that you don't think of him as a writer. You think of him as an insightful person. It's kind of like a great salesperson. You don't think like, oh, that person's a great salesperson. You're just sold. You just love them. You just want to buy from them. You just want to move forward. You don't think like, oh, they're so good at sales. You know, so when you read Seth stuff or any really good writer stuff, you don't think, oh, they're a great writer. You just think they're a smart person, or they're an insightful person, or they're a thought leader, or whatever. So I think when people mimic and replicate surface level tactics without understanding the underlying constraints and assets that the original person is working with, then that's where you get into trouble. I think what you need to do is assess your own assets and constraints. What do you bring to the table? What are you good at? How do you see things differently? What are the things that are constraints that you want to work around? Because Seth has constraints also. He's not good at everything. You just don't really know them or see them because he has designed his work around that. And so similarly, we all need to look at ourselves. Stop looking so externally, trying to copy other people's service level tactics, and instead look at ourselves and take stock of your own assets and constraints.
It's funny because like this is literally the ethos of everything that I've built Unmistakable around. I mean, my book was called Unmistakable, Why Only Is Better Than Best. And I've always jokingly said we could have also titled that book Everybody Is Full of Shit. Penguin probably wouldn't have published it, but that's effectively what I said. I was like, I just said it in a really polite way. Because, you know, you point out mimicry, and that was what I saw over and over again, right? To this day, and I still see it, you know, like I had a friend send me about 13 potential podcast guests. And I remember, you know, and I probably shared this on Dribble before, I put up all of their websites, you know, in one browser, all tabs, and I looked at all 13 of them, and I emailed her and back, and I said, I don't want any of these people because I don't know what the hell any of them do. And it sounds like they all do the same thing. And I saw this. I saw this in particular with certain groups, Marie Forleo USB School being one of them, where people basically, you know, try to copy her style, you know, her business, and then they wonder why they're not getting the same results. And it's like, go, you know, take a deeper dive. And to your point, like, they ignore context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great example.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I feel like I could talk to you all day about this because clearly you and I are on the same page about a lot of this. This seems like a really deep rabbit hole. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Ooh, what makes someone unmistakable? I think their ability to turn bugs into features. I think all of us are dealt a certain hand and have certain personality traits a lot of times that we wish were different. You know, I, for example, spent many years wishing I were less introverted and lamenting about how that, you know, wasn't beneficial in the workplace, wasn't seen as a positive thing necessarily as a leader. And it was really only when I embraced the idea of turning bugs into features that I thought about how a lot of the reasons I've been successful is because of my more reflective nature, my self-awareness, my instinct to think about something, and want to process it instead of just, you know, blurting something out. And, this applies to products too. You know, I think a lot of times we have a product and we think, oh, I wish this were different, or I wish this were better, or, you know, it didn't have this, or, you know, this product is too complicated, or this product is too simple. But if you turn a bug into a feature, there are people who are looking for a solution that is very simple. There are people also looking for a solution that is more complex, more robust, more customizable. So, you know, I see this as something that I apply, you know, to myself as a person, but also to any product that I'm, you know, responsible for selling for marketing. And this idea of turning a bug into a feature, I think is something that can really take every leader to the next level.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your insights and wisdom with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
I have a website at westko.com and a newsletter that I send out every once in a while. I am on Twitter at wes_ko. And then Maven is at MavenHQ and maven.com.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.